Thanks, Peter. So I'd like to begin by actually thanking the organisers for inviting me here for this month. It's been very, very enjoyable and very fruitful. So I've had good contacts with people, and that's been very nice. I'm from a thing that's called the Centre for Mathematical Biology, which is part of the Mathematical Institute in Oxford. And it consists at the moment of 18 sort of graduate students and postdocs that are working on different aspects of mathematics and biology. And half of what we do is actually pattern formation. And the other half of the stuff that we do is bits and pieces of other stuff. And part of that is the cancer modeling, which is what I want to talk about today. So this is an area that I just got involved in about 2 years ago. So what I thought I would do to begin with is to give you a very, very brief overview of some of the modeling aspects of cancer, and then start to talk about the sorts of things we're trying to do. So cancer begins by basically a mutation. So something, cell that's perfectly normal, something happens to it, becomes abnormal, and then it starts to grow. Starts to proliferate, and this actually is an example of pattern formation, because what you end up getting is an avascular structure where you have a spheroid, roughly speaking. When you grow these in the laboratory, this is what you get, where you get a central region which is necrotic, so all the cells are dead in that region. You then have a region here of quiescent cells, so these are cells that are perfectly viable, but they're not dividing. And you then have a rim of dividing cells on the outside. Now, this is a diffusion-limited aggregation, because this, the only way this organ, if you like, can get nutrient is through diffusion. So it can only grow to a certain size, then it can't grow anymore, and that's why these things here begin to die. The cells begin to die in here. And this is roughly 1 millimeter in diameter. And a sort of side issue here is that you've all heard of a very big area in research at the minute, which is tissue engineering, which has become very, very important, partly because we're all going to live a lot longer and all our bits are going to be worn out, so we need to replace them with new bits. And this is the problem they have in tissue engineering, is that the tissue grows to about 1 millimeter in diameter and then dies. There's exactly this problem here. The cancer grows to 1 millimeter, and if the cancer was as thick as we are at the minute, the cancer would die. But the cancer is more clever than we are, and it starts to secrete chemicals. And what those chemicals do, which is thought are secreted due to the fact that you've got necrotic core here and you've got hypoxia. Hypoxia is just a name for lack of oxygen. They create these chemicals which are called tumor angiogenesis factors. These tumor angiogenesis factors diffuse into the medium. And then if here is a host blood supply going along like this, what the tumor does, what the tumor angiogenesis factor does, is it causes cells that line along the host blood supply to actually this becomes dissolved, and then these cells start to move out towards here, and then they join up, and now you've got a blood supply going this way. And then these will branch out, and they'll join up, and very soon the tumor will have its own blood supply. So that allows the tumor to gain nutrient, it allows the tumor to get rid of toxins, and perhaps the worst thing about it is that it allows the tumor to metastasize. In other words, bits of tumor that have broken off can invade this into the blood supply, get carried to somewhere else, and when they get to somewhere else, they can break out again, and that whole process of invasion going into the blood supply, then invasion out of the blood supply, is not fully understood. they go into some other organ and then cause a lot of problems and person dies.
Question.
Yep.
When you talk about diffusion limited aggregation, I didn't understand what is aggregation?
Well, sorry, I mean, that's a good point, actually. It's not really an aggregation. Basically, what's happening is you've got a piece of tissue here that's using nutrient proportional to its volume, so it grows as the cube of the radius, but it's only getting the nutrient from the on the surface, which of course proportional to R squared. So after a while, there simply isn't enough nutrient diffusing in there for the thing to grow.
Diffusion
limited growth should be what it's called, yeah.
And to what extent is this a general, known to be a general scenario for cancer? And to what extent is it even known to be the way things happen in vivo as opposed to in vitro?
This is very general. I mean, the formation of the vascular tissue. And in fact, the thing is that there's a good question here concerning the fact that this you can't actually detect. These are too small, you can't detect them. But yet they're growing in the laboratory. So there's a question here, which is why bother studying this at all? Since usually when you detect a tumor, it's vascularized, which is this part here. But one motivation for studying this is that it's usually the metastases that kill you. And once you've discovered the vascularized tumor, you sort of know then that they're metastasized tumors in the body, and these may be of this size. So that's one of the reasons why you want to try to understand them.
There are avascular tumors.
Oh yes, that's right. Yeah, they are avascular tumors. That's right. Yeah. And of course, there are many, many different types of tumors. All are slightly different, so I'm talking more in a generic sense here.
Presumably, this is a pretty general thing for cells to do because, of course, cancer doesn't evolve. It's hijacking some mechanism already there.
Yeah.
But is it known what class of cells will secrete these things under what circumstances?
Well, it's thought that the tumor, that can actually get the normal cells to secrete TAF. Also, when macrophages, which are normally cells that come in when there's any tissue damage, and one of the roles of the macrophage when they come in is to clean things up, but also like in wound healing, is to actually cause new vasculature to come in. So macrophages will come in here and start trying to build a vascular system, which of course is exactly what you don't want in this case, but is exactly what you need when you have a wound.
So why doesn't it work with tissue engineering? Why don't the macrophages?
I don't know. I think the system isn't developed because it's not in the body. I guess what they could do, they could put macrophages in there and try and see what would happen. But the problem, one of the problems of tissue engineering is that you don't have a body system there. Yeah.
What about the rest of the cell that used to be there? Are they now just stressed and pushed out?
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to come on to those. Yeah, because that's another important aspect. In fact, that's the next transparency. So what we have then is, I mean, you've now got this set of cells that are starting to grow. And what they do is, so they're moving about an ECM, which is extracellular matrix, which is a mixture of collagen and all sorts of other things. What the cells do to invade is that they produce proteases, which are enzymes that degrade the matrix. So in other words, give them room for them to move in. There's also a competition between normals and tumor cells. In the normal environment, you might think, quite correctly, is set up so that the normal cells are happy in that environment. They're happy dividing, reproducing, etc., etc. And it's a bad environment for the tumor. But the tumor changes the environment. so that the environment becomes good for the tumor and bad for the normals. And one way it does this is by secreting lactic acid. It changes the acidity of the environment, and then it becomes happy. The whole sort of chemical environment is now such that they can enjoy dividing and the normal cells can't. So what actually happens, and this is a model actually that was proposed in the mid-90s by Bob Gatenby, who I think is going to be here in December time, and Ed Golinski, they had the following type of model. And here, with all the mathematical aspects of this, I'm not going into any detail, but happy to talk to people later. So N1 is the normal cells, N2 are the cancer cells, and you don't have diffusion for normal cells because normally they don't move around in a tissue. You then got some dynamics of the normal cells. You then have the cancer cells. Now the cancer cells are invasive, so they do move, and they have some dynamics, and you choose these dynamics to be competitive dynamics, so it's like Lotka-Volterra dynamics. And now you've got L-lactic acid. That diffuses, and that's produced by N2. And the key thing here is this thing here that depends on N1. And the dependency is such that if the normal cells are at their normal density, this diffusion coefficient is zero. But as the normal cells decrease in density, that diffusion coefficient becomes larger. And if you solve this problem like you do it numerically, you get the classical sort of traveling waves of invasion. You get that the cancer cells, they're better competitors than the normals. So what they do is they outcompete the normals, reduce the normal concentration or normal density. That causes this diffusion coefficient to become positive. So now they can move, and they move in, and then they repeat the process again. But these traveling waves look different to the ones we normally see in a sort of competition model, in that they don't overlap. You can find a large parameter regime in which there's a gap between the two populations. And it's easy to understand why. Cancer cells are sitting here, what do? They're being outcompeted by the normal cells, so they have to produce lactic acid. They produce that in the surrounding. That gives them a competitive advantage over the normals, which now start to die off, because they now don't like the environment. So the normals die off. Now there's a space the cancer can move in. And then it starts all over again. In fact,
what morphology of N2 are you talking about in terms of the previous discussion?
So here we're just actually talking, I mean, this you can think of it as in one dimension to begin with.
No, but I mean in terms of the previous discussion, which
of the... Oh, here we're just looking at the tumor edge, so we're not worried about whether it's vascularized or avascular. We're just saying we're just looking at how the tumor and the normal, but for both cases, yeah, how do the normal and the tumors and the normal and the tumor cells interact, looking at the interface.
So how realistic is it that everything there is diffusive, right? I mean, there are no active transport mechanisms. So you're still considering the tumor when it's very small.
Yeah. Not necessarily. I mean, this really is just looking at the interface. So it's assuming, it's for simplicity, sort of assuming, let's ignore everything else, let's just look at the interaction on the interface. That's all it's doing. And then they actually went back, I mean, Gatenby is actually a clinician, he actually went back and looked at some pictures of cancer that he had taken, and he actually saw this gap, which he hadn't noticed before. So that's quite a nice example of a mathematical model actually giving an insight to a biological system. And this suggests a line of therapy, which is something that he's trying to explore, which is saying that not only should you be attacking the cancer cells, obviously, but you should also be helping the normal cells to make them a better competitor.
How do you fix this function?
Here's just a very simple function. It's just monotonically increasing as N1 decreases. So you just any function like that will do.
I mean, you get some rates and that will have some speed, and of course that will determine speed will be determined by the.
Yeah, they actually haven't really explored the speed. Really, what they were looking at was the interfacial dynamics, and I think the main result out of this is really this gap that you can form. But one thing we're actually doing is to try and look at the speed of this. But because this is non-linear, and there's actually, I mean, there's also, you know, you've got singularities in it, it actually becomes quite complicated to look at, and that's one thing we're trying to look at from a mathematical point of view, just trying to analyze this. Because, of course, one thing in terms of us then trying to verify this model would be if you could get some analytic expression for the speed in terms of the parameters, you could then test it more with the biology. So that is one thing we're doing at the minute.
How is it that the cancer cells manage to evolve this ability to run due to lactic acid?
That's exactly one of the things that Bob is studying, because the cancer...
It's killing it, right? So they don't really have an opportunity to evolve this.
Yeah.
Is that an internal competition, the cancer cells that produce lactic acid and not ones that don't?
I don't know. See, the thing about the cancer cells is that they actually, in terms of their sort of division and general way of life, are very, very energy consuming. So you would think that these cells have no chance at all of surviving, but yet they do. And that's a big mystery. Nobody understands why do these things that are energetically so useless, they require so much energy, they're not at all as refined as the normal cells, how come these things survive at all? It's an open question.
But I'm confused about some of the biology.
Mm-hmm.
Why are the normal cells dividing at all? You say they're outcompeting the normal cells. I thought the whole idea is that the normal cells are just sitting there in the tissue and they have a bunch of chemical signals that have turned off their cell division.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole issue is that the cancer cells have evolved mechanisms that evade those signals.
Yeah.
So I'm confused by this language of outcompete. The normal cells aren't growing at all, so any growth rate that
But the normal cells need nutrients to survive.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
But there's no nutrient in this equation.
No, the nutrient is being encapsulated by having the division term. It's like a classical, say, predator or competition, Lotka-Volterra competition model, where you say that your two species are competing for food, but instead of putting the third equation for the food in, you just say that if there's more of this species, it degrades the growth rate of the other species. It's a way of telescoping that whole thing together.
That's the part that's confusing me.
Yeah. I mean, also.
Take some random tissue. I don't know what a good tissue is, a kidney or something. So there's an ongoing cells dying, cells being replaced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the cells they need nutrients to survive. I mean, if there's not nutrient, they're going to die.
There's no cancer. And just the question of what is the steady state?
Yeah, it varies. Different tissues, for example, if you look at the skin, and the skin's being replaced all the time. But then there are other tissues where there won't be as much, obviously. It depends, like, for instance, the gut, which Angela points out, is something that, you know, because it's actually somehow external, because it's dealing with the environment all the time, you have to have a quick turnover rate. But then there'll be other tissues where there'll be very, very small turnover rate.
Right, but if it's a very small turnover rate, this language of the cancer cell having to grow faster than the other one, I mean, I'm just confused by that language because the other ones are not growing at all.
But I mean,
now they could be killing the other cells.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. But they could be also using the nutrients that the other cells need to have in order to survive, because a cell needs nutrient to survive. Yeah. So that's a competition. The two things are competing for nutrient, and the cancer cell is getting more of the nutrient. Because, see, the cancer cell needs more nutrient in order to divide, because the cancer cell is so energetically uses so much.
Questioning whether how general this growth scenario is the N1s, and what you're saying is that it's one particular possibility, the other is just simply food.
So, I mean, this model, the way it's set up, I mean, if there was no N2 and no L, all you'd have here would be a nice steady state for N1. Nothing would happen. It'd be so boring.
But it does, but there's food. Like there's some energy.
That's right. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But I think we really develop that, especially in these places where we have a high
transformation. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But that's because you have more transmutation. It's not necessarily because you, I mean, according to this argument, that would be worse for cancer because then you have a rapid growth rate of the normal cells. So the fact that you have, that's a different reason.
Well, that just doesn't mean the model is likely to be applicable where you...
I mean, really what one could do in terms of developing this model is to also have nutrient in here and have the fact that, you know, N1s and N2s need nutrient to survive, but N2 uses up more nutrient than N1. And as a result of that, N2 survival rate is going to go down anywhere where it contacts the N2, because there's going to be less nutrient there. So, but I mean, that's the typical case in any competition model one has, and one telescopes all that into just getting rid of the nutrient. And just saying that if you've got a very, very aggressive competitor, it will result in reducing the amount of the less competitive person. But certainly, you're absolutely right that in terms of developing these models, one has to bring more and more of that detail into play. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
So one other question is the cancer thing: is that sometimes people are told they have a precancerous something or other, like in digestive
tract or something like that. What does that mean? Does that just mean that it's, you know, like
ulcer conditions or something?
Does
it increase the rate of the mutations that would start
the
cancer? What's precancerous?
Actually, I don't know. I've never heard that. Sorry, I can't tell. Does anybody know what that means? So what's the difference between that and benign, then?
Oh, you have benign hypoplasia. I'm sorry, but in some cases it's considered insufficient.
All right. So, I mean, I should point out that there are, although I've concentrated in this model, I should actually add that concerning this angiogenesis business, there are a lot of models, and you'll be hearing about those in the meeting in December. So there's been a lot of mathematical modeling of this business here. There's been a lot of mathematical modeling looking at the at this, and actually trying to understand the mechanics of this. There's been a lot of mathematical modeling on this, on the mutation. And one thing I haven't mentioned at all is the interaction with the immune system. So there's been quite a bit of modeling on the immune system, because the immune system gets involved in this as well. That's something I'm going to come on to later on, because we've got a theory which I don't know if it's correct, but we've got one anyway. So virtually in every particular thing I've mentioned, there have been lots of mathematical models on them. And so, of course, the main reason why you're studying these is to try and come up with therapies. So the sorts of therapies that one has, I mean, obviously there's kill the tumor cells or cut them out or something, and then there's various problems with that. You kill them by radiation or cut them out. Surgery. Then there's the fact this angiogenesis, the process of which is blood supply is formed, then there's a lot of work being done on anti-angiogenesis drugs. So can you give drugs that will actually target these new vessels that are being formed and cause them to disintegrate? And in fact, you can do that. Which is what, I mean, I just think biologists are amazing, because when I first saw that, I thought, what a stupid idea, because how are you going to get the drug into the body? Okay, it's going to have to get carried to the cancer by the vasculature, and if this drug is to destroy vasculature, it'll never get there. But of course, they can develop drugs that can latch into various sort of properties of new vasculature. So this sort of vascular destroying drug gets carried by the body's vasculature without any problem, gets into the new vasculature that's surrounding the cancer and destroys that. So there's a lot of work on that. And then this new idea that's really come out of Bob Gatenby's work about the idea of, why not also try to treat the normals and help them to fight back against the cancer and not let the cancer grow?
Has anybody thought of dealing with of neutralizing the lactic acid production?
Well, this is the sort of thing that Bob Gatenby is looking at. Looking at these ideas of basically trying to make it much more difficult for the cancer to divide. So that's really, and so most of these models are sort of continuum models. So the sort of thing that we've really started doing, and by we, I say Helen Byrne, who's a faculty member professor in Nottingham University, she and a postdoc that we both supervise, Thomas Alacon, have been working on this. And we're sort of starting off very much in the thing of looking at, can we build a whole organ model for cancer? I don't know how much people here know about these whole organ models. There's a real push now to develop models that try and take into account many, many different things. For example, Dennis Noble and Peter Hunter have a whole organ model for the heart, very detailed model for the heart, and this is part of the Physiome project. And in fact, that model for the heart has actually been used by the FDA and by pharmaceutical companies in terms of getting drugs passed. Yep. Well, my understanding was that the FDA used it to pass the drug through one level, but then the drug failed at the next level. Oh, right. So then obviously I've been okay. So I've obviously been misinformed. But these whole organ models. I mean, the sort of idea of these whole organ models and the whole problem of multi. So if you think of modeling in mathematical biology, it presents problems that that are unique, because one thing you have to do is you have to model over many, many different length scales and many, many different time scales. That in itself is not unique. What is unique is the fact that it's very difficult to do homogenization and whatnot, because the particles, the entities you're averaging over, are not all the same. And even two cells of the same type are not the same. So it causes a lot of problems.
Can you, maybe I have a philosophical question. So let's say you succeed in building your whole organ model, what are you going to be able to predict? What is your goal for prediction?
Well, this is exactly what I'm coming on to now. There's two ways you can do this. One way is that you can adopt the sort of engineering or the physiome approach, which says that we can build this model, so let's build it. It's not clear what question you're trying to answer. Another approach, which is very much the biological way of doing things, is let's try and answer specific questions, like the Gatenby model, which was saying, let's forget about vasculature, let's forget about the mutations and everything, let's try to focus in on the interface between the tumor and the normal cells, and let's try and get some idea about what's going on there. That's very much how a biologist thinks. And this is very much our sort of thinking, because a biologist does exactly that. By answering these fixed questions, and you can ask whether that's a realistic thing to do. Because, you know, when you're trying to answer how does a tissue invade another tissue, you're ignoring a lot of other stuff.
Let me ask a question. Let me give you an example for the heart, right? Mm-hmm. I know where I... One type, you know, if you're asking the question of how much of a shock do I have to give for the whole heart in fibrillation, I might be able to get by with a relatively simple model for all the ion channels. Whereas if I ask the question, what's going to happen if I give a beta blocker at 10 micromole, and to somebody who has, you know, a particular region-dense issue, then I'm going to need a model that, at the very least, had better include the channels and the dynamics that that drug is affecting. So I'm trying to figure out what question. So if your questions are, you're going to give some drug that's going to act on the cells to change them, and you really want to predict that, you better have some, you know, real biology in there versus some general question like, what happens if you could reduce the pH or something, and how would that
happen? I'll give example.
No, which mm-hmm. yeah. do you want?
I'm going to give example at the end where we use it for drugs. I think another important thing to realize here is that what we want is a better model than what people have at the minute. I think that's one thing that when people talk about modeling, I mean, all the points that have been raised here are very important points. But you've got to bear in mind where the situation is at the minute. So the idea is not to develop the absolute model that will explain everything. The idea is to develop a model that even if it's slightly better than what people think about at the minute, it's an advance. So by no way, no means am I saying, I mean, I would be very, very scared if any model I developed was ever used to produce a drug or something. I would be the first person not to take that drug. But I view the modeling as being a way of trying to help the experimentalist, because it's the biologist that gets the results. It's not the mathematician or the theoretician. All the theoretician can do is to think of the modeling. I mean, every biologist is a modeler. And mathematicians, we're modelers as well in this area. We think about modeling slightly different to the biologists, and maybe because we think slightly differently, we can add something to the biologist's model, because every biologist has a model in their mind when they're working on something. And we're just trying to say, can we give you a slightly better model? So what we're going to do is, rather than build this big model, we're going to adopt the biologist's approach, which is to try and answer very focused questions with very simple models, and therefore try and get some understanding of tiny, tiny bits of this huge, impossible task, and therefore try to build up a better understanding of the whole thing. So with this sort of vertical integration, and in fact, you know, there's people that do this where at every level, for example, there are companies where you have people whose job it is to read the biological literature every single day to find out which new molecule has been discovered, which new ion channel is discovered, and then let's write down a reaction diffusion equation for that. Then what happens is, of course, you have a huge number of equations, which you then, when you build that into the next level, you exponentially increase the number of equations. So you end up starting with a biological system that you don't understand, and you replace it by a biological system, that you, a computational system that you don't understand, and the computational system into the bargain is wrong, because all models are wrong. What we, our view in this, is to try and at the horizontal level, try to understand the biology, try to therefore see what's going on at that level, but the mathematical step is then to try and caricaturize that into a smaller model that takes the essential elements at that level in a workable way that you can fit it into the next level. So that's the philosophy. Okay. But as I was saying, that the journey of 1,000 miles starts out with the first few steps. We haven't even got to the first few steps. Okay, we're at the crawling stage, and sometimes I think that we've actually made this journey even longer by going backwards. But the questions that we're going to try and answer are the following. what are the effects of environmental heterogeneity? Because the models that I've talked about, well, I haven't actually mentioned the details of them, I've just said people have done models in all these areas, they tend not to talk about the heterogeneity in the environment. So we're going to start off by talking about a model that tries to address the issue of what are the possible effects of environmental heterogeneity. Then we're going to talk about a model for the cell cycle, which will look at the problem of quiescence, the phenomenon of quiescence, and then talk about how we've actually used this model to try and understand the effects of a certain drug in a particular case. So the mechanism that we, the setup that we have here is that the tissue level signaling, for example, nutrients, angiogenesis factors, growth factors and everything, are going to be modeled as PDEs, partial differential equations. The cells are modeled as automaton elements, and then within the cells, the cell processes that are going on within the cells are modeled as ODEs, for example, cell cycle, molecular things, and all this sort of stuff. So the big goal, the sort of big aim, really, is that cells look at their external cues. How they respond to those external cues depends on their internal state. Their internal state is determined by these, solving these ODEs. In turn, because of the internal state, the cell could modulate the external environment. So you have that feedback. And here's the people who did, in fact, Thomas is the one who's done all the work, Thomas Alacon and Helen Byrne. So the first question we ask is, we want to talk about the heterogeneity. So we say, well, heterogeneity can come about due to the blood supply. So we're going to take a situation where we're going to try to model a piece of tissue, very, very simple problem. You've got a piece of tissue, you've got one level, one sort of vessel bringing blood in, and one vessel taking blood out. We're going to assume, for simplicity, that the network, the vascular network, is hexagonal, okay, which happens in a lot of tissues do have hexagonal vasculature. Cancers don't, but we have to start somewhere. So the idea is the following: you've got flow coming in, you've got flow coming out, you've got a branching network. You've got the fact that blood is non-Newtonian. It's got a very strange rheology. I mean, here's an example of the blood rheology. We're not trying to model the blood rheology. So if you look at the viscosity, as you might expect, as the radius of the vessel increases, the viscosity sort of reaches a steady state. If the radius of the vessel is extremely small, the viscosity is very high, but this is not really a sort of monotonic decreasing thing. You sort of have this strange business happening like this. And this is because of how the hematocrit, which is the blood, the sort of volume of red blood cells within the blood, is non-uniform in a cross-section. That's right, yeah. So what we do is we take this, put that effect in, and if we take that effect, and again, I'm not going into details, but I'm happy to go into details afterwards. So we can take our sort of little, our sort of make-believe little model structure, stuff coming in, we haven't put stuff coming out here. So stuff comes in here, flows into these different channels, etc., etc. And if we have a pressure difference between here and here, and we use that mu, we can work out the flows in all these different vessels. And the whole idea of doing that is you want to work out how much oxygen is in there, so that, because the cells are going to respond to the oxygen, so we're considering oxygen as a nutrient. So one thing we have to do is we have to consider the vasculature structural adaptation. of the vessels. And here we're actually using work that's already been done by other people. So the idea here is that you look at the radius at time t. How does the radius of a blood vessel change? Well, it turns out that the blood vessel wants to achieve a certain transmural wall, it wants to achieve a certain wall shear stress. And this you can work out in terms of the pressure, and people have done that. People like Prez have done this for various blood vessels. So this is a mechanical stimulus. And basically what this is saying is that we can work out the wall shear stress for the particular flow we're having, and this will try to evolve to be of this sort of wall shear stress that this blood vessel can support. We then have a metabolic response. So Q dot is the velocity of blood, of the blood flow. H is the hematocrit. So somehow this is a measure of the amount of sort of red blood material that's moving through the system. And the idea here is that if the blood vessel is not receiving enough metabolic stimulus, it will actually grow and widen so that it can increase the amount of flow and get up to this reference level that it demands. So one thing we'd want to do in future is to have this depend on the tissue, because the more demand that you know, the tissue needs more demand for oxygen, that should stimulate the blood vessels to grow. We haven't built that in at the minute. What I'm doing is presenting to you a very general, a generic framework in which one could build these things in, depending what question does you want to ask. And then there's a shrinkage. The idea here is that if there was no blood flowing, then the tube would eventually shrink and die, which is what's observed. And once we've figured out the structural adaptation, then we can figure out the hematocrit, and then once we figure out the hematocrit, we can figure out the oxygen concentration. So how does it work? You start off with a certain amount of a certain pressure difference and a certain amount of hematocrit. You use Kirchhoff's laws and whatnot to figure out the flow rate. Then you compute the distribution of the hematocrit. You update the radius of each vessel through the structural adaptation. One thing I didn't mention, I showed that Fourier's Lindquist effect, which had mu changing as a function of the radius, but mu also changes as a function of the hematocrit. So that has to be put in and is actually put into the system. So this is the next step. We have to compute the viscosities using the hematocrit distribution and stuff from beforehand, and then we repeat until we get a steady state. So very, very simple system. We're not assuming that the tissue in any way interacts with this vasculature. We're saying, given this vascular system, what will happen to the tissue? So, well, first of all, what will happen to the sort of the distribution of the flow? So here we start off with this nice idealized hexagonal system, blood flow network, and these pictures probably won't come out very well, but the important thing is not the detail of here. The important thing is that we work out the flow rates, the hematocrit, the radii, and all these sorts of things, and they're not uniform. They're heterogeneous.
Between this and that hierarchical picture you showed before, the very first branching, is the branching?
Oh, yeah, so here, this is why these pictures are not actually pretty good. Yeah, actually, you can see some of the branching here. So these are sort of the branches here, and so really what we've done is you really need to look at these two pictures together. So here's the these are the blood vessels, and then this is a measure of the flow in each vessel. So what you need to do is you need to superimpose this onto this. So for example, this height here tells you there's this much flow in some vessel over there somewhere.
This isn't the steady state. Is this a snapshot?
No, you keep doing this until you reach a steady state. This is a steady state, yeah.
And it's because there's an imposed...
Exactly, that's right. There's an imposed flow, yeah. That's right.
The steady state under the boundary condition of a particular imposed flow,
yeah.
And that's how you get the branch.
Yeah, no, that's right. So now we've got, or we should mention, we need parameter values, and again, I don't want to go into the details of all of these, but most of these come from experimental sources. Some of them we have to sort of work out, but most of them we can get straight from the literature. So now we've got, now we take this system and we can now get the oxygen distribution. The way we get the oxygen distribution, well, let's assume that the oxygen distribution is on a fast time scale, so we put the d by dt equal to naught, so we've got diffusion, and we've got this sort of term here, and depending, this is a source, a sink term, I mean, for normal cells, so we've now got a vascular network. The vascular network brings oxygen in. I could better do this, easier to do this way. Oxygen diffuses across from the vascular network into the tissue. So that's the boundary condition internally. We just assume zero flux boundary conditions at the edges because we don't want to look at edge effects. And then within the tissue, the oxygen is being used up by normal cells and by cancer cells. So that's the oxygen. And so now the cells receive this oxygen, and what are they going to do with it? Very, very simple rules. We just put in division rules. We just say that if the oxygen is above a certain threshold, the cell will divide. If it's below a certain threshold, the cell will die. Very, very simple phenomenological model. How do we build, except that for the cancer cells, we say that there's another thing. If the threshold, if the concentration is above a threshold, the cell divides. If it's below a threshold, the cell becomes quiescent. And then if it comes back above the threshold, the cell can divide. So in other words, the cell lives to fight another day. How do we build in this effect? So I'm thinking of another word that isn't competition, Herb. We say that if, how do we build in the interaction between the two? We simply say that if there's a lot of cancer cells surrounding the normal tissue, then the normal tissue needs a higher level of oxygen in order to divide. And that's a way of trying to build in the fact that the cancer cells are going to... it's detrimental to the normal cell, to the cancer cell. Obviously, when we make this model more complicated and more realistic, what we'd want to do is say the cancer cells use up a lot of the oxygen, use up a lot more of the oxygen than normal cells. So if you're a normal cell surrounded by cancer cells, you've got a problem. Phenomenologically, we just build that in here by increasing this threshold. In other words, making it more probable that the normal cell will die.
There's an asymmetry because of the quiescence,
and also because of this
threshold.
Exactly.
Asymmetric.
Exactly.
They're more favorable for the cancer.
More favorable for the cancer cells. Yeah. And so that's basically it. So you update at each time step. So cells are sinks of oxygen. We've already brought that into here. If the oxygen level is such that after going through all those rules, a cell can divide. If there's space for it to divide, it will divide. If there's no space, then it'll die.
What about the time scale for the cell, like diffusion time scale, for comparison to the cell division time scale?
In this model, we're assuming that at each update, we then see whether the cell should divide or not. So the time scale we're using for the update is a time scale for for cell division. So one of the problems with this then is that it makes cell division synchronous, which it isn't. Okay, so we have to, that's a point that I'll come on to later. So what we do then is, so we simulate this, and I'll show you, actually show you this, this is a, these pictures are not very good actually, but here's the invasion dynamics of the...
So you had this vasculature network, all that did was to provide a boundary condition.
And the oxygen.
Network of cells.
That are responding to...
Which is a square lattice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, so this is the lattice here.
Initial distribution of cancer and...
With initial distribution of cancer and with the distribution of nutrient that's come in from the vasculature. And so what we have here is, and these are, this is very bad, difficult to see. Actually, these are cancer cells, and these are normal cells, and these are empty spaces or blood vessels, because on top of all this, you've got this hexagonal structure of the blood vessels. And this is just to show that you can see the cancer cells growing. And then what you can do is you can do sort of, you can see what the numbers are, and what you find in this situation here is you get that the cancer cells, a certain number of cancer cells growing, normal cells seem to oscillate, quiescent cells seem to grow like this. Remember, the whole idea of this was we were trying to understand what is the effect of heterogeneity. So what we want to ask is, what would happen if instead of having this heterogeneous oxygen distribution that was brought in by the normal, by the vasculature, suppose that same amount of oxygen was there, but it was homogeneous. What would happen then?
But you haven't shown me that. You don't know.
Oh, no, but the heterogeneity is because of... because of this. Yeah, I mean, here's the oxygen O2 distribution, which is heterogeneous.
Right.
Yeah. So now we say, well, okay, let's assume that the oxygen level is homogeneous, like this. Now what happens? Well, now here's the cancer growing, but the key thing is if you look at these pictures here, and if you look at the scale, you see that there's a 10-fold increase factor here. There's a lot more cancer. So the effect of the heterogeneity versus homogeneity, there's a huge effect here. So what that suggests is that in a homogeneous environment, the cancer, within this very simple model, we always must take that into account, this very, very simple model. Yeah?
The growth seems to saturate because it feels the whole tissue, or just saturates to a size?
It just saturates to a size, yeah. It's not to do with the whole tissue. Yeah. Simply because it then uses up too much of the oxygen, yeah, so it can't keep dividing. So what this suggests is that environmental heterogeneity restricts dramatically the ability of malignant colonies to invade healthy tissue. Now this is why I'm an academic and not a salesman. The gaps in this model, I mean the really exciting opportunities that this model holds. And this reminds me of a story that a friend, Jonathan Bard, tells about his story about a little boy who's the son of a businessman, and he goes to school the very first day and he learns mathematics. And he comes back and he wants to show off to his father that he knows mathematics. So he says to his father, "Dad, what's 2 + 2? And his father says, "Are you buying or are you selling? If you're buying, it's 5. If you're selling, it's 3. So if you want to buy this model, you point out all the gaps, which in fact a lot of you have very nicely done for me. if I'm trying to sell this model, I'm going to say these are really exciting opportunities. You can really build in this model, you buy this model, and then I can sell you all sorts of other parts that you can stick into it. There's no growth of vessels in this model. There's no angiogenesis. So that's something that we need to build in. How could we build that in? Well, one way we're thinking of building that in is that once there's a decrease in the oxygen level, so that the cells become hypoxic, they produce VEGF. They produce other growth factors, but they produce VEGF, which is one of the growth factors being very well studied. That actually causes the tumor vessels to grow. So one way you could build this in is very much like you do in root, in when you study in roots. If you're studying roots, you don't study a root with all the root hairs. You study an effective cylinder, effective size. So one way you could build this in is to say that VEGF should be put into that adaptation process, and that should cause the vessels to be bigger. Immature versus mature vessels, I'll actually come on to that a bit later. Cell cycle, this idea we have in this present model that all the cells are synchronous is totally incorrect. So we need to build in the cell cycle so that each cell has its own timing going on and it divides when it wants to. And with this we can then address the issue of quiescence. There's what I've called competition. The idea that we've, in a very phenomenological way, said that if a normal cell is surrounded by lots of cancer cells, it's got more chance of dying than if a cancer cell is surrounded by a number of normal cells. But why is that happening? That's happening because of the different uptakes of nutrient. So that's something that could be built in. We haven't coupled the vessel dynamics with cell dynamics. We've said the vessel brings this stuff in, and then we look at how the cells evolve. But of course, how the cells evolve, they'll use up nutrient, they'll use up oxygen, etc. That will send cues to the vessel, and the vessel will change its morphology as a result of that. So that's something that one could talk about building in. Growth factors, well, I mentioned one, VEGF. Haven't talked anything about various mutations that cells might undergo. Geometry, that might have an effect. Remember, actually, one thing is we've got a two-dimensional tumor here, flat tumor. You don't see many of those. Okay, and then my pen ran out. So a lot of new mechanics, you could build all sorts of things into this. So one thing we've been trying to build in is cell cycle dynamics. Why? Well, it'll affect nutrient demand. Hypoxia-induced quiescence seems to be very, very important. Because the normal cells can't do this, but it's the cancer cells do this. And that gives them a big advantage. It means if the oxygen level is low, they can just sit and wait until the oxygen level comes high again. We had that in, but in that sort of phenomenological way. So now we want to try and move away from the phenomenology and build in more mechanistic things. And one other reason is that, of course, a lot of drugs work only on cells in a certain part of their cell cycle. So if you want to see what effect does the drug have on the cells in terms of killing them, you need to know where the cells are in their cell cycle. No.
In your model?
In the model at the moment, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that seems like a big difference.
Yeah.
Which one to put?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the cell cycle, well, I don't want to go into the details. There have been lots of models for the cell cycle. Basically, you've got, four phases, G1, gap, then S, G2, M. So there's a switch from here to here that causes the cells to divide. You've got two families of proteins, and basically these things interact with each other. I don't want to go into the details of it. I want to present a caricature model of this that Tyson and Novak presented, and then this was their beginning model. They then have done a lot more detailed, very, very beautiful work on this. But the idea is the following. You've got two ODEs that describe, we've just taken two generic proteins from this interaction. They've actually looked at much more of the interaction between these two things. And you've got the mass of the cell. So I better make sure I get this the right way around. So these are the null clines of this system. And it's set up such that at the beginning, so when the mass of the cell is small, the null clines look like this. So you've got one steady state here, which is stable. It's a steady state that has a high level of this stuff and a low level of this stuff. And that is the state that the cell is in when it's in G1. Then as the mass of the cell increases because it grows, this null cline changes. And the way they've put it in is that this null cline just shifts. So it shifts across to here. And when it gets to this stage, this steady state no longer exists. And you've got a steady state down here, which is this stuff is low, this concentration is high, and this corresponds to the transition to the SG2M phase. And then the cell divides. The cell divides, so the mass decreases, so you shove back to here. So that's their simplest model. They've put a lot more biology into it, made it a lot more complicated, but this is the essence of their model. Now, there's some work by Gardner that talks about the effect of P27. And since we're running out of time, I'll just say briefly what we do is P27 inhibits one of the processes that causes the production of one of these protein complexes. So what we simply do is we go into the second equation from the sheet before and we put a minus KZ, where Z is the concentration of protein, of the P27. Z has the following equation. When there's a lot of oxygen, Z is not switched on. Z is only induced by hypoxia. So the sort of idea here is that if oxygen is very large, you don't see much of Z. If oxygen is very small, then this term is virtually zero. And then we assume, so the question then is, what's the difference between the regulation of Z in normal cells versus the cancer cells? And this is where we make a hypothesis. No biological reason for making this hypothesis. This is our hypothesis. It's either right or it's wrong. We assume that in normal cells, Z is modulated, the production is modulated by the size of the tumor, of the cell. In tumor cells, we assume that growth regulation is lost. So the question we want to say is that if we now add this equation to the equations we had before, with this minus KZ term, can this account for the two different behaviors we observe? The two different behaviors we're trying to get, the following. Normally, this is what would happen. High oxygen level, you get division occurring when this complex goes down and this complex goes up. That's what I mentioned with moving that null cline back and forth. Hypoxia-induced arrest, which is what happens to normal cells, they end up staying in the G1 phase for a lot longer time before they finally divide. Hypoxia and just quiescence means that the cell just switches everything off, it just stays in that, totally in that area, in that state. And in fact, what happens in this state with the normal cells is that if you stay in G1 for a very long time before you divide, then some other process is set in and the cell dies. Here, the cell doesn't die, it just like goes to sleep and then comes back to life again. So these are the two different behaviors we're trying to get. And, well, we can here's some of the results we've got. These are those oscillations again, but what we observe in normal cells, as we decrease the oxygen level, we find that the amount of time spent in G1 increases. And in fact, we find that if we decrease the oxygen level by 1/40, we find that the G1 phase increases by 25%, which agrees with experimental work. But look at what happens to the cancer cells as the P goes down. The G1 phase doesn't, I say I've labeled the G1 phase incorrectly here, it's this level here, so here it's 2000, here it's bigger still. Here, you simply go right up to here and you stay here. The model is simple enough that you can understand it by bifurcation diagram. And basically what's happening is, as you vary M, what's happening is you're starting off here, you go like this, then you drop off to here, the cell's divided, so M decreases, so you go back, go up to here. So there's your oscillation. Now what happens at the point of division if P is very small? In the normal cells, you just stick at this level. In the cancer cells, and this is a rather, this is a log plot, so these are very, very small values, what happens is you stick up here. So you don't divide. You stick in quiescence. Another prediction of this model is that in normal cells, you have a lot more P27 expression than in tumor cells. So this says that low expression of P27 is a bad thing, and that's what experimentalists have observed. So the take-home message of this particular model is that by using the biologically known or ideas that people have of how P27 is affecting this interaction of these protein complexes, taking that biology, adding to it a model hypothesis, which is that P27 in normal cells is regulated by the mass, in abnormal cancer cells is not regulated by the mass, that is sufficient to give the behavior of a lot of what's observed experimentally. So that hypothesis is maybe right, maybe wrong. So the very last thing in the last minute, possible application, this is work actually with Zvia Gur and a group in Israel. They've been looking at doxorubicin, which is a drug applied for the treatment of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. What happens in this case is that when non-Hodgkin lymphoma surround a blood vessel, they actually make the blood vessel go from being mature to being immature, in the sense that the blood vessel becomes very leaky, becomes very unstable, and doesn't cause much stuff to flow through it. We can build that into the model. We've built in the doxorubicin. As it moves through the vessels, it undergoes pharmacokinetics. As it moves through the tissue, it undergoes pharmacodynamics. It kills proliferating cells. One can build all that in by simply now taking the system and this other equation. And one can explore different protocols of treatment. For example, in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, in one of the grades, I think a high grade, at the minute, a 21-day cycle is given. You give the drug every 21 days. What our simple analysis here shows that, in fact, that mightn't be the most optimistic, the most optimal drug delivery regime. The delivery regime should be shorter than that, say every 10 days. So that would be something that experimentalists could test. I'd certainly be the last one to say that that's what one should do, but one could test it. So to summarize, what we've tried to do by taking this model is to try to build an understanding of this system of philosophy is very much the biological approach, which is to try and answer simple, well-focused questions in which you make a lot of simplification. But our feeling is that that's the only way to go. That's why biologists do it that way. It's the only way you can go. The other way, which is to take everything into account, means you don't get anywhere. And remember, the goal is to try and increase our understanding from what's already known. The goal is not to develop something that explains everything, because we'll never be able to do that. What we've shown within this framework is that heterogeneities have a profound effect on tumor dynamics, and that that's an important thing in models that have been proposed thus far, which actually don't take heterogeneity into account. We've talked about the effects of P27, how it's known that it causes quiescence in tumor cells, non-quiescence in cancer cell in normal cells, and we've come up with a simplified model of the full model of Tyson. We've made tried to understand what mechanism, and we've made an hypothesis of what the mechanism is, how it's different in the two different cells. And then we've talked about efficiency of drug treatments. And we presented something there. What are the future directions? Well, one thing is that we are now developing quite a big group in Oxford to try and look more at the numerics of these things, because as you develop these models that become more and more complicated, you need more and more numerical schemes. Like one of the problems with like the big Hunter-Noble heart model is that it takes something like, you know, half the world's computing power for it to simulate for like 1 second or something. So if you want to see, I mean that's an exaggeration, but basically if you want to see what happens if you over the heartbeat over several minutes, you simply can't do that with that model. So we need to be developing better numerical techniques to look at this. From modeling point of view, I mentioned the whole list of things that we totally ignored, and I didn't, there's by no means an exhaustive list, but what we're trying to do is to bit by bit build in each one of those things and do so by trying to ask a particular biological question and therefore build that little part of the jigsaw puzzle into the whole system. And of course, one of the things that we want to do then is that as we take out the phenomenological stuff and actually build in a mechanism, then we have to ask the question, well, did the result that we get when we had phenomenology there, is that robust to this fuller model? And that's one thing that we have been doing. So the first model I presented was just this, the heterogeneities have a profound effect. As we've built in growth factors into the model, as we've built in the cell cycle into the model, we've gone back and we've tested those results again with this more sophisticated mathematical computational model and shown that the results are robust. I think what will be, I don't think that's particularly interesting. What I think will be interesting will be when we put some step in like that and find that the results are not robust to that step, because I think that will give us more of an insight than the fact that it is robust. So I'll end there. I'm sorry for running over time, but happy to take any more questions.
I didn't understand which precise phase of the scenario that you described initially this model was meant to describe.
So this model is looking at a vascularized tumor. So it's looking at the situation where the tumor has its own blood supply, it's already in the tissue and it's growing. And what we want to try and understand is how can we stop that growth from occurring. Actually, another thing we haven't built into this model is cell motion, because the cells will actually be actively moving, which is something we need to build in. And one of the things we want to try and do with this model is by looking at the cell-tissue interactions and the mechanics of the system, is to see whether under what conditions one of these cells could invade the blood vessel and then go off and form metastasis, so somewhere else. That's one of the aims of this model, to try and understand metastasis. And the other aim is to try and understand how you can give drug delivery to a tumour, because one of the big problems with drug delivery to a tumour is that there's a lot of pressure, mechanical pressure, inside a tumour that's pushing stuff outwards, so that if you try to inject, the stuff doesn't go in. So by building mechanics into this system, which in fact is a big grant proposal that we literally put in last week to try and get a group of 8 or 9 people to actually just work on understanding the mechanics of a growing tumour, that's one of the things we're aiming to try and understand. Yeah.